Well, I asked beforehand whether I should give some meditation instruction and was told yes, I should. Now, if you feel I shouldn't and you just want to sit down and meditate, that's fine with me. Do you want to get some meditation instructions? Yes, all right. And also, I always feel it's helpful to hear, even if it has been heard before, why one should meditate. It's not just an idea that one is going to get something out of it, because in the beginning, one mightn't get anything out of it. But there is a very definite reason why a human being, any human being, should meditate. Ordinarily, we look after our bodies. We know very well what to do. We eat, and we sleep, and we wash it, and we exercise it to some extent, and we make sure that we have certain comforts at home, and we get pretty irate if we don't have certain comforts. And then when the body gets sick, we also go to a doctor or a homeopath or whatever is our intention. And if we look for a moment at our own home, in your mind, just look at your own home for a moment. It's all arranged for the body. There's a kitchen. Well, we have to eat, we have to cook, right? There's a fridge for all sorts of food to be kept in there. There's a dining room, maybe, where we eat and put the chairs and table. We have a bathroom, it's for the body. We've got a bedroom for the body. We've got a living room with some nice chairs, comfortable chairs that we can sit in, and that's about it. We might have some books around which give information, but we don't have the comfort that we have for the body. We don't have that for the mind, and we don't have the care and concern that we have for the body, for the mind. Now, exactly what we're doing for the body, we should be doing exactly that, at least for the mind. The food that we put into the body should be healthy, and it should not be dirty, and it should not be poisonous. And we all make sure that it is. Well, it's the same for the mind. The food we put into the mind, it should not be poisonous. It should have no dirtiness in it. It should be very healthy. Health food for the mind is far more important than health food for the body. Because when the mind is absolutely healthy, it can help the body also. Now, when the mind becomes a little upset, angry, worried, it needs the same kind of washing, cleaning, purification that the body gets every day. We all go into the shower every day. But what do we do with the mind? We just let it carry on, don't we? Let it carry on with whatever it's thinking. And we don't really, usually, make any great attempt to clean it up, to wash it, to purify it. The body gets a rest every night. If it didn't, we would be totally out of commission after a very short time. 2 or 3 nights without sleeping, and we would have hardly any energy left. And what about the mind? It thinks from morning to night, and it dreams from night to morning. It doesn't get a moment's rest. When we take a rest, we think of taking a rest for the body. The mind keeps on going. And if we have, for instance, a very expensive tool, And we would run that continuously without any let-up. And on top of that, would leave it out in the open. Open to the elements. Would never clean it up. It would very soon completely deteriorate. Well, we could trade it in for a new one. But we can't trade in our mind. We've got it for the duration. We need to look after it. And this is something that most people don't really know about until they hear about it. That it is even more important to look after the mind than it is to look after the body. That doesn't mean we shouldn't look after the body. We should. Because if the body gives a great deal of trouble, then the mind is troubled too. But the mind needs to be looked after. And one day, we know that the mind can take care even of troubles of the body. The Buddha said that the unenlightened person has two arrows that hit them, and the enlightened one, one. The two arrows that can penetrate us and hurt us are mind and body. The body hurts, the mind reacts. But for the enlightened one, there can only be the body. The mind doesn't react. For us, it's important that we look after both, and that it becomes very clear that the mind is the master. The mind's in charge. If your mind hadn't told you to come here, your body wouldn't be sitting here. The mind has to make up first its itinerary. It has to have the determination to do something, and then the body can follow. Actually, subconsciously we know that. And yet, consciously, most people in the world don't look after their minds. They take the mind for granted. Whatever it thinks, that's supposed to be so. Otherwise, one wouldn't be thinking it. But that's not so. It's not so at all. Because when we start to meditate, we can recognize the fact that we can change our mind. And how often have we said, I just changed my mind? And how often have we changed our mind? We can. It's no great difficulty to change our mind. But we have to know which way to change our mind. And this is where the meditation comes in. Looking after our mind means that we're going to give it a rest. When we get concentrated, one day we will give it a rest, so it doesn't have to think. And from that, just like the body, gains a great deal of energy. By having a rest at night, by the same token, the mind gains a great deal of energy by having finally the first rest it ever had. So that's one thing it needs. And then the purification. The washing of the body is all very well, but what do we wash? 1/16th of an inch of skin. Nobody believes that we're just skin or skin and hair. We're more than that, aren't we? And yet, that's all we can wash. So soap and water won't wash our mind, but meditation will. 1 second of concentration is 1 second of purification. Because at the time when we are really concentrated on our meditation subject, nothing else can enter. We can't be desirous of anything. We can't have ill will. We can't worry. We can't be restless. We can't hope or be disappointed. We're just concentrated. Luckily, our mind can only do one thing at a time. So we have to have that kind of purification, because it's the only kind we're going to get for the mind. There's nothing else we can do. When we realize that we can actually change our mind in the meditation, namely from discursive thinking to concentration, because we want to do that, we also realize at the same time that we can do that in daily living. And then we realize that we can change from unwholesome thinking to wholesome thinking. And that way, we continue the purification process outside of meditation. So we've got the rest for the mind, and we've got the cleansing of the mind. Also, if we didn't exercise this body at all, it would really deteriorate. It probably would become paralyzed. Well, the exercise for the mind is not trying to think many things, but to learn to put the mind where one wants it to be. Just like if we were to do some exercises with the body, we would put the arms or the legs or whatever we're using where we want them to be, or at least we would try. Try to touch our toes with our fingers. Well, it's the same for the mind. We try to exercise where that we can put the mind where we want it to be in the meditation. Now imagine in daily life, if you put your mind where you want it to be, would you ever get unhappy? Nobody in their right mind would voluntarily be unhappy. We'd always put it there where we want it to be. If we don't recognize the great importance of looking after our minds, we're not going to meditate because we think we don't have time. There's too many other things that take people's time. But all the other things that we do are either geared towards the body or geared for survival. And none of that will ever happen. But for the mind to have time for itself will give us the opportunity to have a better quality of life, because the mind can expand. It's just like doing yoga exercises or physical exercises. If we do those, we eventually loosen up. The body becomes looser. The our muscles aren't so tight. And we have more facility to move. It's the same with the mind. As we use the mind for concentration, for putting the mind where we want it to be, the facility to loosen up and expand comes to us, and therefore we have more perspective, a greater horizon. When the horizon is limited, our ability for the quality of life is limited. To look after our mind is the essential aspect for a really satisfying life. If we don't do that, looking after the body comes to grief eventually anyway. Most people's bodies deteriorate quite markedly when they get older. They might be lucky and not get terribly sick, but it isn't satisfactory. But the mind doesn't have to get older. The mind can become clearer, sharper, more luminous, more expanded, more malleable, more flexible. In fact, old age should help for the mind to be all of those things. Meditation is such. In the beginning, it doesn't seem as if we get benefit from it, because it's difficult to stay concentrated. Why is it difficult? Well, there are two main reasons why it's difficult. The first reason is that the mind is habitually used to discursive thinking. It hasn't had the training to stay in one spot. It's just like when we start yoga exercises. It's difficult to reach one's toes, maybe, because we haven't been used to it. After a while, we get used to it. It's quite simple. Here's the same thing. So we are not used to that exercise, so it's difficult in the beginning. But there's another reason, which is a little more far-reaching and a little more difficult to overcome. The only way we can ever be sure that we're there is when we're thinking. And so subconsciously, although consciously we would like to stop thinking and become concentrated, peaceful, blissful, and all the rest of it. But subconsciously, the mind balks at it. It doesn't want to stop thinking, because if it stops thinking, it may not have any ego support. It's much harder to overcome, much more difficult to overcome than the exercise that we need. But both together will bring us finally to the point of real concentration. Now, what we do in the meditation is that we use methods. The method is not the meditation, but we need the method in order to get to the meditation eventually. If you don't have methods, this will never happen. So the method which we're going to use, and which is traditionally the most widely used method, is watching the breath. From it, some very interesting things can be ascertained. The first thing that we actually can notice is that mind and body have separate functions which are intertwined but can never be substituted. The body breathes and the mind observes. You can't turn it around. You can't have the mind breathe and the body observe. It's impossible. And by only understanding that bit and not believing what I say, but noticing it when you start your meditation, you will recognize the importance of the mind. The mind is there to know. The body is just there to have this life quality. But the mind is there to know. And if it makes you aware of the fact how important the mind is, and makes you aware of the fact how important it is to look after it, then your evening will be well spent. So we use the breath and we observe it. We actually experience it. In our ordinary day-to-day life, we take the breath for granted. Unless we start choking or we have asthma or for some reason there's not enough air. Then, of course, we panic. And then we also realize at that time that breath is the foundation of life. But breath is the foundation of life at all times, particularly when we don't get into this panic. So now in the meditation, we're not going to take the breath for granted. We're going to experience it. We're going to actually be aware of it and live it. And we can start out by extending some love towards the breath, because it's keeping us alive. Most people would never think of that. Just ordinary. Breathing is very ordinary. Actually, all our teaching is very ordinary. That's why we can grasp it, understand it, and use it. We are ordinary, the teaching is ordinary. When we look at the breath and see that it supports our life, we can be thankful for it. And we can be grateful to the breath. We can have a loving relationship to it, which will help us to keep our mind on it. Because it's difficult to keep the mind on the breath, we'll use some crutches. And I'll explain four different ways to help us keep the mind on the breath. The first one is counting. One on the in-breath, one on the out-breath. Two on the in-breath, two on the out-breath. No more than 10. Every time the mind starts thinking, back to one. Because if you don't, the mind starts thinking about where you've been. And it starts discussing that. Maybe I was at 4, or maybe it was 6. Or should have been 9 actually, or something of that nature, and then the discursive thinking continues. So just automatically back to 1. If one doesn't like numbers, one can use a word. Any word will do. The word peace is a good word. If you know a better one, use it, but no more than two syllables. Peace on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath. Or, peace on the in-breath, calm on the out-breath. You say it to yourself, but you always keep the breath with it. The breath is the main object. These are, so to say, props to help the mind to stay where it doesn't really want to stay. It wants to think. Then we have the possibility, if you are visually inclined, to use visualization. Namely, you can use an ocean wave. The breath comes in on the crest of an ocean wave. You can make it bright blue with silver foam on top if you're into Technicolor in your visualization. Some people are very good at visualization. If you are, use it. If you're not, don't try. It's not necessary. One uses that for which one has a propensity. The ocean wave comes in with the breath, the ocean wave goes out with the breath. Since that's a rhythmic happening, and the breath is also rhythmic, it can be extremely helpful. And the fourth possibility is using sensation. Namely, the sensation which arises at the nostrils when the wind of the breath touches the nostrils. And we can follow that by becoming aware of sensation in the nose, forehead, throat, and lungs. But we don't look for the sensation. We just follow the breath and see what we can feel. And as we go in and then we go out. When we do that, stay as near to your face with that going out breath as possible. Meditation takes place within. Everything that's external is a disturbance for meditation. That's why we try to have very quiet places so that there's no disturbance of sound. That's why we close our eyes so that there's no disturbance of sight. And we do get disturbance of the touch contact, but here in the chairs that wouldn't be noticeable at all. So you pick one of those, counting, or a word, or the visualization, or the sensation, and you stick to it. Believe me, it's not the method that makes any difference. It's the mind. But pick the method which you think will be most helpful to you, most conducive to being able to stay with the breath. Now, when the distracting thoughts arise, and for beginners, distracting thoughts arise in a very quick succession, try to label. Now, if you're a beginner, you won't be able to label all of them. There'll be too many. If you're not a complete beginner, you may be able to have some concentration and then have the a thought arise. Now, labeling it should be something like future or past, planning, remembering, disliking, being bored, worrying, whichever one comes to mind. The first label is the right one. It's no use trying to find a better one. That, again, is a new discursive thinking. This labeling, and then, of course, after having labeled, the thought dissolves. The observer of the thought is no longer the thinker. This labeling is an enormous help in day-to-day living and also in understanding ourselves better. A labeling tells us, first of all, what our usual habitual thinking pattern is. Because you will find it's either constantly future or constantly past, constantly planning, constantly worrying. You will find there are some variations, but there is something which is major. And you will find your thinking pattern. And also, it will tell that what we're thinking is not necessarily very useful. It goes for all of us. Until one starts meditating, one is of the unequivocal opinion that what one is thinking must be so. When one starts meditating, one finally finds out that thinking are just thoughts and nothing else. And when we labor, we see that. What's there to worry about? There's nothing to worry about. We're all sitting here nicely and peaceful. What's there to plan? There's nothing to plan. We're just sitting here. That's all. What's there to remember? Nothing. What's about the past? Why aren't we in the present? In the present means to be on this one breath. We cannot observe a breath which is gone, and we cannot observe a breath which is yet to come. We can only observe the breath which is now. So when you feel the difficulty of that, you will know how difficult it is to live in the present. And you will also realize that thoughts are just thoughts. And that's a great breakthrough. That's a first step into spiritual life. Meditation has to be part of a spiritual life. It doesn't work on its own. But one has to see it for oneself. So then, having labeled, we have those two benefits. First of all, we know our own patterns, and also we don't have to believe everything we think. But we have another enormous benefit from the labeling. As we learn it in meditation, if we continue this in daily living, we can substitute anything that's negative with something that's positive. And our mind pattern changes, our reactions change, our whole demeanor changes, our whole perspective changes. It doesn't mean we don't know what's good or bad, but it means that we don't react negatively, that we don't have the self-pity, the depression, we don't have the negative feelings towards others. And that brings about a level of being which has a different quality. Just as we substitute any discursive thought with attention on the breath, so we substitute in daily living the unwholesome thought with the wholesome. That's why labeling, especially in the beginning of one's meditation practice, is of the greatest importance and brings immediate benefits. This sort of meditation brings immediate benefits on several levels. It, as I have explained already, it makes it possible for the mind to actually stay put eventually. It is the method for doing that. So we pick one of the four different props I have explained, and we label the discursive thinking. Now, before we start, maybe there's some question about anything at all that either is not clear or I haven't mentioned. Oh dear. Does anybody have any question of about anything that's not clear or that they have done in the past and want to know about? Try to turn his lights off too, huh? I know what you're saying, but that's not the way it works. The way it works is the minute you label, you know this is nonsense. It's totally unnecessary. And as you know it's nonsense and totally unnecessary, you get back to the breath. Of course, you get a new thought. I mean, if one hasn't practiced for a long time and very diligently, naturally there'll be new thoughts. But the labeling itself is the way to interrupt the thought process, because you don't interrupt the thought process otherwise. How do you interrupt it? Now, if you get concentrated enough so that the thoughts are diffuse, that they're not really easily recognized, then you don't need to label. That's neighborhood concentration. If you have neighborhood concentration, if you have meditated long enough, then you get neighborhood concentration. And when you have neighborhood concentration, you have the feeling that you are actually on the breath, but that there are thoughts in the background. Well, then you don't have to label. But if there's just thought, you've got to interrupt it. Otherwise, it keeps going. It might go for the full half hour. Not the same thought, obviously, but it goes on for the whole half hour. That's not uncommon. You know. So for neighborhood concentration, no need to label. Okay. I think we all know that what we're most looking for in life is happiness and peace. We might not say so, we might not even admit it to ourselves, but it's basically the search for all human beings, and one can say that it's a search for all beings on all levels. I want happiness and I want peace. We don't seem to get very much of that. There seems to be something wrong somewhere. And when we don't get it, we tend to blame something or someone. Since we know that if we blame another person, we're going to be in more strife, we often blame something. But there's really nothing to be blamed. We don't go about it in the right way. The lack of happiness and peace is due to our reactions and not to what happens outside of us. Now, the Buddha explained four different kinds of happiness. And the first one of that, we're all very well acquainted with. And people who don't meditate and don't practice any spiritual discipline, any at all, will only know that first one and nothing else. But that first level of happiness will never be quite satisfactory. First level of happiness comes through our senses. So seeing, hearing, tasting, touching, smelling, and also through thinking. In the Buddha's terminology, thinking is our sixth sense, which we also use in our language. We sometimes say I had a sixth sense about that. And we're well acquainted with the happiness that we can get through the senses. But unfortunately, the way a human life is constituted, we get half and half. We get 50% pleasant sense contacts and 50% unpleasant. If we get less than 50% pleasant, our karma isn't very good. If we get more, we've got very good karma. But this is the usual way. Half the time things are nice and half the time they're not. Now, our general and ordinary reaction to all that is that we would like to enlarge upon the times that we have pleasant sense contacts and diminish the times that we have unpleasant ones. And we do anything we can in order to come to that solution. If we have lived long enough and given it any thought, we should by now know that it doesn't work. It remains half pleasant and half unpleasant. That's just the way it is. We see things we like, we see things we don't like. We hear things we like, we hear things we don't like. The same about tasting, touching, smelling, and thinking. It goes on all the time. The whole of mankind is determined to find their happiness through their senses. And if we haven't done anything else, that's what we're doing. Our whole economy is based on it. Nothing else is being sold except that which is supposed to please our senses in some manner or form. The whole of mankind uses time and energy in order to get and to keep and to renew a pleasant sense contact, that which gives a pleasant feeling. And a lot of time and energy to try to get away from that which is unpleasant. It could be people, it could be situations, it could be the weather, anything at all that we don't like, we try to get away from it. Now, if we for just one moment examine our daily activities, we will find that that's what we're doing. Sometimes we're forced to stick around where it's unpleasant. And then we call that having a problem. And then we try to solve that problem by getting away from it, by getting away from the unpleasantness. There's bound to be some other unpleasantness. It just happens over and over again. The Buddha called the happiness through the senses the very first level, but he also called it a danger. Because if we get too many pleasant sense contacts, we will imagine that we could get only pleasant sense contacts and put all our time and energy into that and nothing else. We won't even try to find another level, another quality of life. It will just be that. Now that would be an extreme sensual life. But some of that is embedded in everyone. Now that doesn't mean that if we want another quality of life, that we will then have no pleasant sense contacts. On the contrary, we can have refined pleasant sense contacts. We can have pleasantness by being in nature, enjoying a good conversation. We can enjoy good music or a good book. So we have refined pleasant sense contacts. There are also, of course, gross ones, like alcohol or drug. And those sense contacts, which are supposed to be pleasant, turn unpleasant very quickly. Whereas the refined ones don't turn unpleasant, but they're very short-lived. We can't keep them going. So we have to use time and energy over and over again to renew them. And if we do that, we often don't have any other time left over, which in the end turns into I have no time for meditation. And if we do that, we also very often find ourselves having no time for others. Because we're so busy getting pleasant sense contacts, there's nothing left as far as time and energy goes. Now all these are the dangers. On another level, the Buddha compared our sense contacts with a cow that has been skinned and flies are landing on the raw flesh. Constant irritation. Because our sense contacts are constantly requiring our mind to do something with it. See, the eye cannot see anything other than color and shape. It can't even see whether it's pleasant, nice, beautiful, anything like that. The mind has to start working. So we work from morning to night to digest our sense contacts. And the digestion then brings about the reaction. We need to watch ourselves, become attentive to ourselves, to recognize this process and see how unsatisfactory it is in the long run. Even the most pleasant sense contact has to be short-lived, otherwise it becomes unpleasant. Just imagine you're having a very nice meal, just telling your host, this is lovely food. So the host says, be my guest, eat for another 2 hours. Dreadful. Not only physically, but also emotionally. Nobody could handle it. It's got to get over. We've got to get over with that after about 20 to 25 minutes, and that's it. The same with all our sense contacts. They got to be finished. Otherwise, they become extremely unpleasant. A meditator, a person who has an interest in meditation or an interest in spiritual growth, has other possibilities. That does not eliminate our sense contacts. Our senses are there for survival. It's much easier to survive if you can see and hear as if you couldn't. They are our survival system. But they are certainly not meant to be our only happiness-bringing system. So we need to have some other avenue. Now, another avenue, the second level of happiness, is called the deva happiness. The devas are a higher realm of being than the human beings, but it doesn't mean that we have to die and become, get reborn as a deva or change our outer form. It's just the name. It means that we are training ourselves towards the four divine abidings, which are the highest emotions. Unconditional love, compassion, joy with others, and equanimity. Now, it means a training of the heart. Meditation means a training of the mind. This means a training of the heart, of our emotional states, which are very often angry and resentful, worried or proud, disliking or bored, restless, unhappy. All of these emotions are, of course, not conducive to happiness. And again, we're trying to find an outer trigger that has caused us to be unhappy. The outer triggers that cause us to be unhappy are nothing but triggers. They're not unhappiness producing. They're our reactions are unhappiness producing. So when we start training our hearts towards lovingness and compassion, we have another foundation which is not dependent upon all these outer triggers. Because usually people love when somebody loves them, love when somebody is lovable, have compassion when somebody is dreadfully unhappy and requests it, requests some help. Usually people don't go about even thinking about loving others. We all know, love thy neighbor as thyself. We've heard it from the time we were old enough to go to Sunday school. Who can do it? It's a training. It's a skill. And it starts with oneself. If we are to love our neighbor as we love ourselves, we have to first love ourselves. Loving ourselves is not indulging ourselves. On the contrary, it's just the opposite. Loving ourselves means having a warmth of feeling for the person we are in spite of all the difficulties which we know we have. The spiritual and emotional growth which is possible for a human being goes to the outer limits of total liberation. But we've got to start somewhere. And we need to start with the understanding that the happiness through the senses can never satisfy us. We'll never be contented. We'll be contented one moment and discontented the next. And because we're discontented the next, we will look for a new sense contact. And it takes up everything we've got. Now when we develop our faculty of the heart, and we all have that faculty, we all know what it's like to love somebody. We have that faculty, but when we develop it to the point where it isn't somebody, but where the heart actually has the ability to do that, then we have a strong, rock-like foundation for inner happiness. And also for inner peacefulness, because it gives us the security that whatever happens outside of us, we will be able to respond with a loving and compassionate heart. When we know that, we feel secure, we feel at ease. It doesn't matter what's happening, what people say, what people think. Will be able to love them. Now that takes skill and practice. Everything that we've ever learned and that we've become skillful at has required practice. Whether it's driving a car or whether it's using a typewriter or a computer these days, everything we've ever learned to do well, we've had to practice. This is practice. And the Buddha's teaching is often inquired into. Is it a religion, a philosophy, a psychology? It's all of that. It's practice. That's its overlying truth. Everything else is underlying that. It's a practice path. A practice path which brings a widening of the quality of life, an enhancing of it, a much deeper perspective, and a profound understanding in the end of what absolute truth means. The four supreme emotions which the Buddha talked about is this unconditional love which does not need to be personal. Of course it's directed towards persons, but it has nothing to do with the person that we are confronting. The other one is compassion, which means empathy. The far enemy of compassion is of course cruelty. But the near enemy is pity. To have pity for another person separates us. We're sorry for another person that they are in such a bad condition. And very often we're very glad that it's not us. In fact, sometimes it goes so far that we'd like to actually remove ourselves because we're afraid that we might have the same condition. Compassion is something entirely different. Com means with, passion is strong feeling. It means with feeling. And that can only come about when we've understood our own suffering, our own unsatisfactoriness, our own discontent. Whether on a large or small scale, when we've understood that there's something within us which is searching for completeness, that there's something within us which is not totally at ease, then we know what other people go through. And then we can be with them. Now, by the same token, just as love is impersonal, so is compassion impersonal, because everybody has exactly the same problem, except giving it different names. We all call our problems by different names. That's fine, it doesn't matter. It's always the same thing. When we found it in ourselves, we can be with others. And when we are with others, and we have actually been able to transform our feeling for ourselves, wanting things for ourselves, to a feeling of wanting to give to others, we have another source of contentment. Because when we don't think about ourselves, we couldn't possibly have a problem. We can only have a problem when we think about ourselves. The minute we think about others, all problems vanish. Now, the impersonal love and compassion are the foundations that give us an inner peacefulness, which makes it possible that we actually learn also to concentrate. If we really want to meditate, we have to have a joyful mind. A troubled mind, a bothered mind, a worried one, one that's desiring or disliking, can't possibly meditate. The more the mind is troubled, the less it can meditate. The less we can get near to the third stage of happiness, which is concentration. In that third stage of happiness, we actually touch upon a different dimension. The dimensions that we know are the everyday reality, where there's nothing but duality. It's either you or me, or them and us, good and bad, male and female, tomorrow and yesterday, wanting and disliking. That's the everyday reality, and that's called the relative reality. And in that relative reality, to find contentment, real deep down contentment, which is not dependent upon outer conditions, is impossible. It's not only difficult, it's impossible. Because we're constantly confronted with conditions, even the conditions of our own body. When we get concentrated, that is one thing that vanishes, the condition of the body. Now, as I said before when I was talking about the meditation, the method is the way to get us there, but it isn't the meditation yet. The meditation starts when we can leave the method behind. When we leave the method behind, attention on the breath, we leave that behind, and the concentration actually starts, we touch upon a totally different realm of experience. the previous practice of educating our heart towards love and compassion is a precondition. We don't have to be perfect in it. But as long as we're totally concerned only with what we ourselves want for ourselves, we could never get concentrated. Concentration cannot be wanting anything. Concentration has to let go. In order to concentrate, we have to give ourselves fully to the task on hand. In this case, the breath. If we give ourselves fully to the task on hand, we have learned that by giving ourselves fully to love and compassion. Obviously, our daily activities are often beset by the opposite, by dislike and ill will, and by self-centeredness. And this is where our daily practice comes in. Every one of us is confronted with enough people every day to practice love. That's what other people are for, to practice love and compassion in our own hearts. Everything else is just a mental concoction. We've got plenty of mental concoctions, but they don't make us happy. And since all we want is really happiness, we could try something new. Trying something new means that we're not set in too much in our grooves. So if we have this daily practice of using everyone we meet to practice loving them and having compassion for them, we will be able to eventually give ourselves totally to the concentration. Because love and compassion means giving oneself. If we don't have that giving, we won't get a thing. We have always known that giving is far greater than getting. But what we know and what we do is usually miles apart. That's human nature. There's nothing to blame in us. The formula is recognition, no blame, change. There's nobody to blame. Human nature is like that. But we can transcend it, and we can find a reality of happiness which goes far beyond the ones we know. So when the concentration comes together, which means that we have practiced the purification of our heart, and we have practiced the concentration, we enter a realm within us which is delightful. And our first step inside of ourselves tells us immediately, without the shadow of the doubt, that this delight lives within us. Most people in this world never get near it. For the lack of instruction, sometimes for the lack of interest, but mainly for the lack of emphasis. All our educational institutions emphasize the mind. We've got to know, we've got to learn, we've got to remember, and we've got to make a living. In those instructions is nothing, there's nothing contained within them that will show us that there's something entirely different which lives within us. If it wouldn't be living within us, we couldn't get at it. We can't stick it in there. We don't have any openings other than our senses that we can stick anything in. It's already in there. And already being in there, we need to touch upon it. We need to get in touch. And to get in touch with ourselves means we've got to stop thinking and emoting and reacting and planning and worrying and hoping and remembering and trying to figure out who's right and who's wrong. Essentially, nobody's right and nobody's wrong. Everybody's deluded. But none of that matters if we really want to get in touch with what is within us. We can do so. We sit every day and become aware of the possibility of being with the breath by giving ourselves totally to that experience, giving our self-centeredness away. There's nobody there that we need to be concerned with while we're watching the breath, and yet everybody is totally concerned with what they're thinking about. It's all going on in the mind constantly, this, that, and the other. By giving ourselves up at that time, we touch upon that inner reality, which starts out with delightful sensation and goes on to inner joy, inner peace, contentedness, and deep peacefulness. When we start getting the first experience of that, we know for certain that we'll never find that kind of happiness through the senses. It's a totally different ambience. And it doesn't mean that we can't have happiness through the senses. On the contrary, it means that our happiness through the senses will be much enhanced, because it will become much purer, because we're not going to search for them so much. We're not going to search for the sense contact so much. We don't have to see and hear and taste and touch and smell and think. We know there's something else. We don't search. We don't have to hang on to them. We don't have to repeat them. They happen anyway. And through the purity of the sense contact, they have a far enhanced and quality. We take them with gratitude, but the mind and the heart know that they, in our meditation, we can get back to that inner reality which has everything in it that we've ever looked for outside. Having all that within us means the third stage of happiness. It is confined to the meditation period, but it does have a residual effect in daily living. We know where we can go to find the comfort and the home for heart and mind. The fourth level of happiness is a kind of happiness which can remain with us. It's not confined to either a brief sense contact, nor is it confined to the quality of our heart, nor is it confined to the meditation period. And that's insight. Insight into the absolute reality as compared with relative reality. In relative reality, everything is as we see it. Every person is separate. We all sit in a separate chair, have a separate body, and mainly we try to protect ourselves from each other as best we can. We certainly lock our doors, put big fences around our gardens. We don't tell the deepest secrets that we carry within to someone else. In fact, we're terribly judgmental. We see a lot of things in other people that we judge, and very often judge negatively. We have a feeling of being isolated, which we try to overcome within the family, but which remains with us, because isolation is isolation. And because of this feeling of being isolated, we alienate it. And because we're alienated, we're also threatened. We not only feel threatened by nature, we feel threatened by our neighbor. Maybe we don't even know it. But we certainly don't go around being totally at ease and happy with everyone we meet. So this separation is a relative reality. If you look around, you will see everybody looks separate, but it's an optical illusion. I'm sure everybody knows already that there's nothing else in the whole universe except particles that constantly come together and fall apart. That's us, all of us. And all our scientists are quite sure that that's what the universe consists of, but have forgotten that they themselves are the same. If they hadn't, they'd probably be enlightened. Particles that come together and fall apart. That's what we are. And there is no separation. It's all happening at the same time. We're all breathing the same air. We're all made up of the same bits and pieces. We all have the same wish, happiness, peacefulness. We're all having the same difficulties, and we're all having the same delusion. We all like to make permanent what's totally impermanent. We all think that that which is unsatisfactory, our sense contacts, are going to bring us happiness. And we all think that there is a special person sitting within. Because of that specialness, we feel threatened. Because this specialness is an illusion, we have to reaffirm it constantly. We don't think it's enough that if we reaffirm it ourselves, we want others to reaffirm it for us. But since they're concerned with the same problem, that they need their specialness reaffirmed, we very often get disappointed. Nobody reaffirms our specialness. And then what? And then we get unhappy, don't like that person, find a new one that might reaffirm our specialness. We all have the same problem, exactly the same. And what it actually amounts to is that there's one creation, and we are all manifestation of that one creation. And that in reality, through our meditation, the concentration, we can become aware of the immensity and infinity of mind and matter. We call it space and consciousness, but it's mind and matter. And the immensity and infinity that we become aware of, if our concentration ever comes together, tells us in no uncertain terms that there is nobody separate around. And once we get that feeling that we're not separate, not special, nobody really who needs to be reaffirmed, just a manifestation, at that time, loving others is the same as loving oneself. There's nobody other. At that time, being with others is nothing except being with oneself. Giving to others is the same as giving to oneself. Having joy with others, which is the third one of the four supreme emotions, is nothing other than having joy with oneself. And having that kind of insight and that kind of experience through the meditative path cannot be lost. That remains with one. And that's the kind of deep and utter happiness which doesn't need any outer condition. The concentration still needs outer condition. We still have to be concentrated. We still have to have a quiet place. It's quite impossible to come really concentrated when a bunch of kids are screaming, when there are many cars going by. So we have conditions And we need that concentration as a condition. But insight no longer needs a condition for happiness. Insight is a change of consciousness. And that change of consciousness is what the Buddha's teaching is all about. It doesn't come about automatically, and it doesn't come about quickly for most people. There might be some lucky ones that can do it quickly, but most people need time. But what it amounts to is that there are instructions and guidelines that we start out with putting our mind on the breath and trying to keep it there. Really sounds very simple. You've tried. It's not, is it? It's not simple at all. It's fraught with difficulties. So when you see that putting one's mind on the breath is already fraught with difficulties, you can have an inkling of the fact of the difficulties which arise in impersonal, unconditional love. But that's no reason not to try. The easy things anybody can do. 2-year-olds these days turn on the television set. Anyone can do it. That doesn't bring happiness. That just brings distraction. The difficult things, they are the things that can actually bring about something totally different from what most people ever get to know. When we get to know our inner being as different through the concentration and have the advantage of an enlarged horizon, a wider horizon and a deeper perspective, then we can see the universe as it relates to us. We can see how to be that part of it, how to be one small part of it. And we can see everything in the context of the immensity of the creation. And we don't have to get upset. We don't have to get worried. We don't have to get angry. We don't get revengeful. We don't get proud. There's nothing to be proud about. There's nothing to have revenge about. There's nothing to be upset or worry about. It's all one creation. And as we purify our mind and heart, we will be able to touch the purity in infinite consciousness so that we have actually access to the purity which exists around us rather than the impurity which also exists. It's a matter of educating our heart and mind towards spiritual growth. 4 stages of happiness: sense contact, love and compassion, joy with others, and the 4th one's equanimity, which I haven't touched upon, concentration, and then insight. That's what the whole path consists of. Now, I'd like to give you a few moments to ask some questions, if you like. if you haven't got any questions, it's either absolutely and totally clear or the opposite. Whichever way, that's the way it's going to have to be. We'll do a guided loving-kindness meditation together, which is something also that you can take home with you and practice. Doesn't take long, and it's extremely helpful if one does it in the morning before leaving the house to go into the world. It can be very helpful to have an easier day of it. In order to start, we'll put the attention on the breath for just a few moments. Imagine that you have some beautiful flowers growing in your heart. Imagine the most beautiful flowers you can think of. They have a lovely color, beautiful aroma, bring you joy. And you can actually feel how your heart opens towards them, that you love them. And with that love, you can fill yourself from head to toe. And now make a beautiful bouquet out of the flowers in your heart and hand it with all your love to the person sitting nearest you. Just out of the desire and the wish to give the greatest gift that you have to give, the warmth and love of your heart. See how that person is happy to receive that beautiful gift. And now think of your parents, whether they're still alive or not. Make an extra special, beautiful bouquet of the flowers of your heart and hand it to them with all your love and gratitude. Let them know how you feel. See how they are happy when they receive your gift. Think of those people who are nearest and dearest to you. make a beautiful bouquet of flowers for each of them. Give it to them with all your love, your friendship, your gratitude, without expecting to get the same thing in return. Now think of your good friends. Let them arise before your mind's eye. And again, make a beautiful bouquet of flowers from the flowers in your heart for each of your friends, handing it to each of them in the depth of your friendship, with the warmth of your love, with your empathy, of your care and concern, letting them feel your togetherness and connectedness, seeing the happiness that that brings about, not expecting anything in return. Think of those people whom you meet in your daily life, your neighbors, people at work, people in the street, the shops, the offices, salespeople, postmen, whoever comes to mind who's part of your daily life. Make a beautiful bouquet of the gorgeous flowers that grow in your heart, and give one to each of these persons with all your love, with all your gratitude that they're part of your life, with all your care and concern, being near to each other, making them truly a heart connection. Now think of anybody whom you find difficult, with whom you may have had some argument, or whom you're angry at, or who's angry at you. And realize that that's nothing but a blockage in your own heart, to your own detriment. Get a beautiful bouquet of flowers ready for that person too, and hand it to that person with your love and compassion and forgiveness, with your understanding of the difficulties that every human being has, making peace. Now think of those people whose lives are far more difficult than ours. In hospital, in prison, in refugee camps, in war zones, crippled, blind, hungry, without friends or without shelter. You know where they are. You can assume where they are. Make as many bouquets of beautiful flowers as you can from the flowers growing in your heart, and give them with all your love and compassion to as many of these people as you can, showing your connectedness, your care, your concern. Your togetherness, giving them hope and a feeling of not being alone. Put your attention back on yourself and feel the joy and the happiness that comes from loving and giving. Fill yourself with joy and happiness from head to toe. Surround yourself with the warmth of love to feel secure and protected. Then see the beautiful flowers in your heart, which can only grow there when there's love in the heart. See them before your mind's eye and anchor the love in your heart so that it's always available. May people everywhere learn to love.